This is an American Crimecast production. Visit us at our new home at accproductions.org. And remember, everyone is innocent until proven guilty in the court of law.
You're listening to Mysterious Circumstances, hosted by my dad.
Alright, everybody, welcome to Mysterious Circumstances Podcast, and I am joined by horror and paranormal author, Mr. Kevin Eads. How are we doing today, Kevin?
I'm doing alright. How are you, man?
Oh, not too bad. Not too bad at all, and finally getting you on here and all that good stuff.
I appreciate it. So, little did you know you have a family member half as weird as you.
Oh, I know, right? You're pretty much the only one. So, and for those of you who don't know, Kevin is my cousin and written several books and
over 20.
Yep. And currently working on getting a movie made, which,
yes.
But before we start getting into that, you did not start off being a horror and paranormal author, I suppose. Why don't you tell everybody a little about yourself, Kevin?
Well, it was a process to get here. I guess the interest was always there, but I went to college and law school. I was a college instructor for many years and enjoyed it thoroughly. But there was always that part of me that enjoyed writing. You'll laugh at this. Back in high school, in my early college years, I was in a rap group, so that got me started with the writing. And, I the good stuff came around, like Nirvana, came around later, so rap started to suck and other stuff took out. But it was, I always grew up with a love of horror. I grew up on a farm outside of Villa, Indiana. And when you grow up on a farm, as you know, your imagination can run wild.
Oh, yeah.
So every little shadow you see is a ghost. Every little thing you see is a ghost or a UFO or any light in the sky. So you let your imagination run wild. I have been writing for a while and collected some stuff. And back home, I met a person, actually a former student of mine, who had started a publishing company, which has become quite large since then. And we talked, and he wanted to publish me, and I put my first book out, which, by the way, was a piece of crap. You know, every time you start out, your first book is not going to be that great. You improve as time goes along. And they just continued to publish me, and I became a bigger and bigger name, and I put some good stuff out recently. So, a lot of fiction. The majority of my work is fiction, but I've done some nonfiction work as well, such as the Eerie America book series, which we started in Paranormal Roadtrip, mm-hmm. which I'm actually, it's a co-authorship, and I'm up for an award on that right now, which has been kind of cool.
Yeah, we've all been trying to vote every day to try to get you up there. It's a pretty tight race right now.
Cool. Well, voting through December 18th, so vote every day. Just remember, it's international. I'm going against some of the best in the world. The organization itself, I remember, right? I think it's out of the Netherlands or Belgium or somewhere, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, definitely.
So I'm not just being recognized here in my own backyard. I'm like you. I'm bigger around the rest of the world, right?
Yeah. Apparently, I'm bigger in Australia than I am in America, which I'm okay with because, you know, hey,
if I remember right, John Mellencamp took off in Australia before he took off in America. So,
well, it must be an Indiana thing then, I guess. What was the final straw for you to finally get your ass in gear, I suppose you could say, and start like writing? And how did you come about doing that very first book?
Well, the very first book, strangely enough, was a collection of screenplays I'd written and sat on forever. I got that idea from, I spent a lot of time at comic book shops. Yeah, everybody can laugh at me, it's okay. I was also a rapper, so it's perfectly fine to laugh. And I had ordered a book, which I thought was supposed to be a comic book from them. It turned out to be a collection of screenplays from old, cult Night Stalker screenplays that were, for shows that weren't released. And it's like, hey, you can do this. This is a cool idea. So I kind of sat on these screenplays forever, and we got those published. And basically, since the reception was good from the publisher and everyone else, we continued to do that for my other first couple books. And I had been writing like crazy for years, because I'm, okay, for everybody out there, I have an active mind. I'm one of those minds that I cannot sleep. So every night before I try to fall asleep, I run an idea for a story over and over again in my head for, you know, for days before I write it down. I just continued to write and write, and every time I submitted something to the publisher, he liked it, so they just put a lot of stuff out. And within the first couple of years, I had 10 books out.
That's another thing I noticed about you. Once you get on those writing binges, you're pretty adamant. You don't stop.
No, well, I've had ideas that are running in my head forever. And, I mean, right now I'm working on a vampire collection, and I just have some really good ideas as a follow-up to this year's True Legends, which has been considered by many one of my two best books, two fiction best books. So I just continue with the idea. I mean, if I'm going to write a trilogy, I'm going to write a trilogy. I don't care. When I've got something in my hand, it's going to get out there, for better or worse, because I've got some pretty messed up stories, too. You know, a lot of them are great, but some of them are like, dude, where do you come up with such stuff? And it's like, well,
you got to get it out, man.
Absolutely. You know, don't get the wrong idea. It's not voices in my head. I'm not completely insane, but it kind of is.
Yeah.
It's hard to explain. It's not the crazy voices we have, but it's the others like, hey, there's a story here. Let's develop it. Let's keep it out there for the world.
So what was your first reaction to some of your feedback on your first book? Was it good, bad, and how did it affect you as a writer?
Most of it was good. It was basically, hey, there's a few mistakes that the publisher missed. And, you know, that bother me, because the initial, when you're working with a small publisher, and you know there's going to be some initial kinks you got to work through, kind of like, you know, when someone has a new software program, there's some initial kinks that have to be worked out. But the overall reception was good. Everyone loved the ideas. These stories were original concepts and original ideas that were pretty well received. It was a couple books in my, I think, second year of writing, I got some of the negative feedback. And you know how that is. Anytime you get negative feedback, it hits you hard. And I understood what they were talking about, but still, it was not all my mistake. Some of it was the mistake of the publisher, some of the printer. Because then you've got, it's hard to explain. Again, when you're with a smaller press, there's many times that the printer itself makes mistakes that are not always caught in the proof copy. And it's like, ah, crap. But all those kinks have been worked out in later years, and all my new stuff has been getting great reception because they're like, hey, you're growing as a writer, you're growing as an artist, you finally found your voice. Like anyone else, I'm sure Stephen King will look at his first stuff and be like, oh my gosh, what the hell was I thinking? But you work out the bugs, you work out the kinks, and then you find your voice.
Yeah.
I mean, you too. I mean, I want to see you put something out because you got a lot of great ideas from your show. A lot of great cases you cover, so, you know.
Me and you have talked about that pretty extensively, and yeah, that will be coming once I get past about, what is it, probably about the 18th or 19th of November. Me and Shane are actually going to start getting that manuscript going, and
it takes time, and, you know, I get it.
It does, and I, you know, I don't feel comfortable enough doing it, you know, myself, just because of wording, and I've never written anything like that. And, you know, I know Shane has, and he has, you know, knowledge of that kind of stuff too. And the case that we're going to do is the death of Thelma Todd, the actress. There's just so much involved there that I think it would make a really, really good book. I think there might be like one or two out there, but I think we're going to try to dive a little bit deeper and, you know, right, put the story of her out there a little bit more, because, you know, she had a pretty interesting life and stuff. So what kind of nonfiction have you touched on? And obviously you brought up, you know, some your road trip, paranormal road trip. And
The majority has been macabre tourism. The idea, it started with Eerie America, which, yep, was released by Schiffer Publishing out of Pennsylvania. And Eerie America is kind of like Eric and I got together. It's like, what if the Addams Family took a family vacation together? Where would they go? So the concept between Eerie America was, let's find not just attractions, but hotels where people could stay, restaurants where people could eat, and places where they could shop that would be very unusual. Some of it was haunted. Some of it would be places that are haunted, like, you know, the murder house out in Iowa. But other stuff would be like the Space Alien Bar and Grill, or what was the one in Little Alien, where they can stay out in Nevada. And the Clown Motel, because I got this big clown fetish, which is another story for another day. But ladies, if you're in the clown, give me a call. And you got to be a little weird to be in this racket.
And that's why you love the magic wand so much, right? The restaurant.
Oh yes. I have written a movie where I had a scene that was going to be set there, but we never got that to materialize. But regardless, we actually pitched the show. We filmed a couple sizzle rolls. The first one we filmed in Salem, Massachusetts, and also at Lizzie Borden's, which was amazing. The second we had filmed in both St. Augustine's and New Orleans. And unfortunately, there were some bad contracts we were tied into and some work that the director did that didn't work out. So we're hoping to revisit that at a later time and we can get other things resolved. And then that brought us to Paranormal Road Trip. Okay, rather than just the whole idea as we did it with anything unusually themed or creepy or weird, you've got restaurants out there that just have completely unusual themes like Jekyll and Hyde out in New York. Well, we were going to stick it strictly to the paranormal crowd, Paranormal Road Trip, which would just be places that can go around the country that are going to be more per se haunted. But I liked the Eerie America the best because it was so odd in general. I mean, if you're on a trip, you want to do something kind of cool. I think the idea is this. Okay, Justin, there are so many people that their vacations to me are boring. They're like, hey, man, let's take a cruise and go to Jamaica. And they take the cruise, which is all-inclusive and boring. They never leave the ship. Or if they do, they go to Jamaica. They never leave the resort. They never see what's out there. Even here in America, they don't leave their hotel or they just go to Disney and that's it. Well, we were writing for those who had a more unusual mind like us to really want to see some cool stuff. You know, if you're going to go to a nightclub, you can go to the same boring one at the resort, or you can go to the vampire bar down the road. And I'll tell you this, if you go to a vampire bar or a Bloody Mary. Okay. It took you a second.
You know, let's talk about your movie endeavors. I know you had just previously mentioned, you know, a couple, you know, have gotten, you know, not so much the axe, but just the
development hell.
Yeah. A couple of them have not, like, fully materialized and developed. And as a person who is currently working on getting one of your books through the motion picture process, tell me how, you know, not really that affected you, but just that's got to be frustrating, I guess you could say.
It is. Okay. The thing with the television show, since I go back every part to the movie, the concept is really cool and original. The problem is you have a lot of the higher execs that are very narrow-minded. The people that work under them love the idea, but the upper execs don't look outside the box. They think that it's a paranormal show. It's not. The reality is most paranormal television is dead. The shows that are still out there are going to continue to be made because they have their audience, but they don't want to make new paranormal shows. They're looking at something else. Right now they're doing a lot of the Bigfoot types of shows, which are saturating the market and will be gone in a couple of years as well. So they could not see the big picture. So we're just going to, you know, redevelop that as we see. Movies are a little bit different because you're kind of doing the independent route. And with that, it takes the funding. Now, I've had a screenplay turn into a movie before. It's waiting to be released. It was called House of Evil. I even wrote a novella based off the screenplay. And the director makes a bunch of movies and he's waiting for the release on that. It's direct to video, obviously, because horror tends to overall saturate the direct to video market. The good thing about horror is it's always profitable. You always see the movies make money. It may not make millions, it may make hundreds of thousands instead, but it's still going to be profitable. Now, if I were in another genre, per se, action, it would be a lot more difficult for us. Right now, we are trying to secure the budget as well as the business plan and all of that. We're trying to tweak it and going to investors. And I may have an investor out in New York right now. We're getting ready to talk to him. He's had interest in working with us before. So it's just getting the numbers, you know, in the right order for him. That's the boring part of it. You see, I like the creative part. The intention right now is we're planning on filming in Indiana, actually, Randolph County. We're friends with the owner. He's a great guy. It's an amazing facility. I don't know if you've been down there before yet, Justin, but if not, you have to go. It's an amazing place.
I haven't been there yet, but I am currently, once it gets warmer out, because, you know, not all of us are in Florida, Kevin, but once it gets warmer out, I'm actually definitely planning a trip down there, and I hadn't really known too much about this place before you had brought it up, and then I started researching it, and it's pretty badass. So I guess on a side note, why don't you tell them a little bit about this place?
Well, I know a little less about the history than my co-producer, because he's written a book on it. I'm more looking at the schematics and looking at what it can do for us. It was an old, infirmary that I guess was both for the sick and for the poor. It used to be if you were so far in debt, I guess they would put you there to work or whatever, which I guess in a way it'd be better than being as far in debt as you and I probably are right now.
Probably, yeah.
but it was preserved perfectly. And because a lot of these places have been run down over the years and are falling apart, but it was bought and it's perfectly preserved. The only thing that really doesn't look great is the paint's coming off, but I think that adds to the ambience of the paranormal investigators like to go and rent the place out for the weekend. It's huge. I mean, you go into this place, it is huge and imposing. And for any project, it's perfect. The first part of the place is more, would be perfect for apartments. It's well kept up. It's carpeted. It's very nice. And then you open these doors and you get into the actual infirmary. Now, my movie is called The Dark Asylum, so it's perfect for an asylum as well. You know, asylums are places for the mentally ill. Unfortunately, we have less and less of those places available, and more of the mentally ill are just being free. But we really do need a few asylums to come back. And when I went to visit the place, because Dan Allen, the owner, is a personal friend of ours. He helped us when we were filming Eerie America down in New Orleans. And he's like, you've got to see my facility. He also owns the Hartford City Jail. And just we're just in shock and awe. It's like, Eric's like, why don't you write a movie that we can film here? And I just went and cracked away and wrote the screenplay in about a day or two because I was like so excited about the idea of working there. But of course, when you're writing a screenplay, you have to go through many drafts. You have to write it over and over again, make the changes. And even when we film, we'll still be making changes the day before we're filming. So
super awesome. I can't wait.
Have you ever visited the prison in Albion, by the way, the little prison there?
Yeah. Museum there. Yeah, I have. It's pretty fucking awesome. For the listeners that don't know, like, my dad's side of the family is from Albion, Indiana. For such a tiny town, I mean, literally one stoplight. I mean, the courthouse is amazing. A historical structure, and it is so beautiful. You can see it from, you know, a mile, 2 miles away, because it's just massive and it's brick, and it's just so cool. And the inside is, unfortunately, I have seen the inside of it a couple times, but the inside is just immaculate. It's
got character.
It does. But that little museum there is pretty badass. It's really cool.
We did that town. Some ghost hunts back when I was in Fort Wayne with the Indiana Ghost Trackers, and it was the only place we ever got any paranormal evidence, which was only EVPs, but regardless. And I didn't care if we did or didn't. Just hanging out at the structure at, 1 o'clock in the morning was amazing.
That is very cool. And speaking of ghost hunts, why don't you tell us about some that you've been on and some of the more exciting and least exciting ones?
The least exciting are always going to be, I hate to say, they're going to be cemeteries. Cemeteries are great places to take a girl and make out and stuff like that, but are to play tag with your friends when you're 30. But it's not a good place to do a ghost hunt because the bodies that are there are already dead. If you believe in ghosts or spirits or whatever, they're going to be in prisons and hospitals and other places, where nursing homes, where people die. The most exciting for me was, as you say, the Albion Jail, and the other was Wolf Lake at the old hospital museum.
Oh.
It reminded me, especially in the basement, reminded me of the basement on the remake of House on Haunted Hill. Now, we didn't get anything there, but still the idea of going to this place that was an old hospital around, you know, I think in the 1800s for a small town and the structure as it was just a beautiful place. The reality was I joined ghost hunting not as much for fighting ghosts, but for getting into these old historic structures at 12 midnight or 1 in the morning and not being arrested for trespassing. So, and just getting this, because as a writer, for me, I was always trying to find new ways to be inspired. You know, we would go to these places and I would look for a story. I had worked, volunteered one Halloween at the the haunted jail over in
Columbia City. Yeah.
And inspired me to write another screenplay that we're actually trying to develop into a very low budget movie with somebody else right now. So
the haunted jail there in Columbia City, that's a pretty good one right there.
It is, and it's so creepy. I don't know if you've ever been in there when it's not, you know, being used, but oh my gosh, it's just walking around is creepy enough. My one friend that I went and worked with, she got stuck in one of the jail cells itself during that time by herself, which would have totally freaked me out. I'm going to be honest. You know, I have a high tolerance for stuff, but working at a haunted house with all the weird stuff, lights and music in an area that is said to be very haunted by yourself in one of those cells, man, that takes a lot.
No, I could freaking imagine.
You can have brass balls for that.
Yeah, that's the damn truth about it, too. I don't know what it is about haunted jails and prisons. You know, on my bucket list personally would definitely be Alcatraz. I would absolutely love to, you know, someday explore that with some technology to where, you know, hopefully get some feedback, you know, paranormal wise anyway.
Absolutely. Well, you've got the Mansfield one out in Ohio, which is also supposed to be amazing. And well, it's not a jail, it's a former hospital, Waverly Hills down in Louisville. I think what the thing is you hear the story of, you know, energy, personal energy. Energy can't be created or destroyed. So you can have a lot of a place like a prison is such a negative place. So all the negative emotions, I think, just start to soak into the building over the years. You know, the misery, the despair, the negative desires, you know, I think it just all gets absorbed into there. I mean, that can happen in a house as simple as that. I grew up when I moved from a villa to four, I moved into a house that had a lot of, I think, just negative energy absorbed in by miserable couples over the years. And just when people walked in, they had a bad feeling, you know, instantly. And I think that plays into it. Same thing with the hospitals, the infirmaries, the asylums. Again, places where a lot of negative energy was flowing. And it seems like it stays around in some capacity.
Yeah, I definitely agree. After we did a little ghost hunt down at the, you know, Hartford City Demon House. They call it the Monroe Demon House. And you can literally walk into that place and almost immediately start feeling sick to your stomach. And it's honestly unbelievable. You know, if you sit there and you try to tell, like, a skeptic about it, and you can't describe the feeling. Because it's just so many emotions going on. And hell, just a couple years ago, you know, they found human remains down in the basement, you know, that were later identified to be, you know, children's remains of some missing kids some years back. And it's one of those things, like, you just walk in and it's just like, this is not a good place. It's
right. Even if you don't believe in ghosts, you definitely should be able to believe in energy. Any scientist, you know, will say energy. Because they say energy can't be created or destroyed.
Exactly.
So it stays in and absorbs into a negative energy, you know.
Well, when skeptics talk about the science factor of it, they forget that little detail right there, conveniently enough, you know.
And that's what I try to remember, because I think it's always healthy to have a little skepticism. Hopefully, obviously, because if you've been on some of these, you know that there's some crazy people on ghost hunts. I think they're doing some acid or something.
Yeah, you never know these days, man. So you've worked with quite a few different people in the TV and the writing genre. Can you tell us about some of your experiences with them and, you know, whether good or bad? Obviously, you can leave names out if it's bad, but...
Mostly they've been good. Again, you're right, I can't necessarily mention the names, but some of them, one of them was on a popular sci-fi show, and just one of the nicest guys you ever meet, and, just perfect to work with, and his partner, who they've done a lot of other work out there together. Oh man, they were amazing. There's been some negative too. Sometimes actresses that, and I think some of the worst actresses are those that don't even have their name out there yet. And they're acting like a diva and throwing fits on the set. That was probably for me the worst thing, because it's like, okay, we're trying to provide an opportunity for you, but if you do this, the audience is going to hate you and they're going to report it. And, you know, everyone's going to be like, if you watch this show, yeah, Kevin's cool and Eric's cool, but this other person, you don't want to meet them. So, you know, you got to be so careful. Just ourselves, we have to be careful how we present ourselves. You go to my Facebook page, for instance, I'm very careful. I don't talk about politics or religion or anything controversial. I'm very careful what I talk about, because you can alienate your audience.
Yes.
I have fans that are probably going to be liberal, conservative, smart, way outside of both fields. And I don't want to do anything to possibly alienate my base. You know, if I were running for office, that would be a whole different ballgame, but I'm not. But yeah, most of the people I've met so far have been good, but there's going to be some bad experiences as well. So I get ready for that.
Yeah, it was funny when me and you were messaging back and forth one night, and you're like, you know, so-and-so, don't ever work with that guy. He's a total douchebag. And it's like, I kind of saw that, you know, but it's nice to actually have it confirmed, because it's like, yeah, he kind of seems like a douchebag on TV. I can definitely imagine he is in real life as well.
Yeah, exactly. But the majority, I would say the majority, and especially in the type of stuff you and I do, are decent people, because they do like their fans and they do want to build their brand and their base. You know, it's important to them. Because I read somewhere, and this is completely off just what we're doing, but The Rock, I guess when he was started out, he was very standoffish and just wanted to be left alone. And his wife, I guess, mentioned to him, you know, you've got to be friendlier. You're not going to have any fans and no one's going to go to your movie. So I guess he started becoming very outgoing to his fans and very, very cool to them, and, you know, snapped for pictures with everyone and shook their hands. And now everybody loves The Rock. Those movies do ridiculously well. But he's on a big scene. So when you're in a smaller one, like, you know, cable television, you need to definitely look out for your fans. Or as a writer, you know, if someone wants to meet me, first of all, if they want my autograph, I wonder what's wrong with them. But if they do, of course I'm going to sign for them. You know, I'm going to do whatever they want within reason. I'm not going to their basement or anything like that.
Yeah. But, you know. Well, your fans, yeah, that basement's probably not a good idea with most of your fan base, man.
No, with my fan base, I'm probably stuck in the crawl space. Are you kidding?
Yeah, so. Yeah.
No, just kidding, folks. I love you. I love you all.
It's a lot of my listeners are different than others, and, you know, I'm sure your fans are the same way too. It's pretty healthy mixture. It's really interesting. For me personally, I know mine are a 50-50 mix of, you know, unsolved true crime, and then half, the other half are in it for the paranormal, unsolved paranormal cases that I try to either debunk or prove. But, you know,
those are the most fun people, let's be honest. I mean, I joke about stuff, but I'm also joking about myself, because I think it's good to have a healthy sense of humor about yourself. But we are an unusual group of people, a motley crew that comes together, and really, I think we enjoy each other. You know, I don't want to say crazy, because people take it the wrong way, but I think we all have to be a little crazy, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And we're drawn, and those of us who, I'll use it this way, unusual, are drawn together. My friend, you met some of my friends back home.
Yeah.
They're an unusual group of people, but they're a lot of fun, and I wouldn't have it any other way. To me, it's boring.
I agree.
When I'm getting together with people, I want to have an interesting night, not a normal night.
Yeah. So what'd you do for Halloween? Did you do anything fun for Halloween, or just go to some parties and stuff? Or?
Not really. I went to Rocky Horror, of course, because, you know, you got to go to Rocky Horror unless there's something wrong with you. But there's not the same amount of attractions and stuff down here as there is up in Indiana.
Really?
In Indiana, I had great parties, bonfires, went to the haunted houses like in Green Center or Huntington or Fort Wayne or wherever. There was a lot more to do. Down here, unfortunately, we're about an hour from Orlando, so everything revolves around Universal Studios Halloween, which is basically just an overpriced attraction for Halloween. No offense, Universal. You've done some great movies, but your Halloween Horror Nights just aren't all that.
Yeah.
I just dressed up like a clown and scared my cats.
Yeah, it is. I will admit, up here, we do have a lot of stuff around. I mean, when I was growing up, it was always, you know, Hand Road out in Huntertown and Devil's Hollow and all that good stuff. And, of course, in Kendallville, you got Spook Hill, which, historically speaking, it's a really cool little cemetery, but it's more of going out there and scaring the fuck out of yourself. And
you'll have to show me when I'm up next, because I've heard of it, but I haven't been yet.
Oh, yeah.
The other one I missed was I guess they're tearing down the old S Bridge, which...
Yeah, they are.
I've got my own stories that I probably shouldn't share anywhere on that, but let's just say it's a great place to take a friend.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, a lot of me and my buddies spent time out there dangling off the end of the... You know, sitting off the end of the railroad bridge, and it's a shame. It's when news came out they were tearing it down, we were actually all pretty disappointed. It's like, man, that bridge is like so many memories for so many people for a long time. You know, it's
that's what you hate to see. There's always been a tendency to tear down what's old and build something new. And the old is beautiful and had character, and the new was boring. Like, where you and I both grew up, I remember you grew up originally on a farm as well.
Yeah.
And those houses are old and they have character. When you go into Fort Wayne, they have all these new houses that are built, and they're kind of, they all look the same. You go outside, they all have the same floor plan. They all look the same outside. It's just, I don't know. I think that can be the quickest way to kill creativity, you know? Maybe that's what they're trying to do. I don't know.
it's the suburban death trap, dude. Pretty much how it is, and I'm not a big fan. Yeah, I just recently moved into Fort Wayne in the city. I live on the north end. So many people, everybody's just hustle and bustle, and I mean, it's a nice area of the city. I'm not going to lie, it's one of the best, but still, it's just like everything's the same. It's all, you know, keeping up with the Joneses and all that shit, and it's like where me and you grew up, that's not what it was about. Like, literally, you had to find your own ways to keep yourself occupied and, you know,
living. But I think that's helped us get where we're at in our careers now. I mean, it lets your imagination run wild. And of course, it would take some dark turns. But I mean, for the podcast you're doing and the writing I'm doing, it was perfect for that. I mean, where else can you be inspired like we were?
Oh, that's true. And I can remember, I mean, I lived right by a cornfield. So it was, you know, the first time I saw Children of the Corn, dude, I mean, that fucked me up. You know, I was like, man, there's kids out there.
you were one of the children.
Yeah. You know what? I would have joined them if it came down to that, Kevin. Been like, okay, I'll go ahead and go with you guys. You guys seem pretty awesome. But yeah, I mean, that's exactly how it is, though. Like, we didn't have city things to keep ourselves occupied. We couldn't walk anywhere. I mean, if I wanted to go anywhere, I'd walk, you know, a couple miles down the road to my buddy's house. And that was only because I was lucky enough to have a friend who lived that close. And it's like, you know.
My friends didn't. Yeah, I know what you're saying. It was far away to do anything. You'd get on a bicycle, I guess. Or then we had a moped, which is, yeah. Oh, now yeah. Mopeds are just for people that, I won't get into it. You know what I'm talking about.
I do know what you're talking about.
But when you're a kid at school, and that was just to go into a villa or whatever. But yeah, absolutely. You've got the things that I think really encourage creativity, like growing up in the country and using your imagination, or that can stifle it, such as being. And those of you who like suburb, it's not a personal attack. It's just it can stifle creativity because everyone is trying to be like everyone else. She says keeping up with the Joneses.
Yeah,
and that stifles creativity, I believe.
Yeah, and you're so worried. There's so many people and so many judging eyes that you're worried about. Too many people worry about what other people think and they yes. end up losing themselves in the process. And I guess that's one of the things I think I'm probably most thankful for the way I was brought up, but the, you know, where I lived, the creativity factor, the imagination factor. And I mean, obviously, you know, my mom, and she always encouraged, you know, being an individual and, you know, kind of carving your own path. And, you know, there's a lot of siblings in my family, and some of us, it took a little longer and went a little bit different routes than the others. And that would be me. Everybody else pretty much went the straight route. But
you see, the thing, when you talk about family, it was also a big encourager. As you say, my mom is very creative, and she always encouraged me the same way. But going further back could also inspire me, because, you know, both of us had grandmothers in France, and while yours didn't share as much about her, mine did. So he had stories about, you know, running from Nazis, climbing over barbed wire fences, and things of that nature, as well as some of just the weird stories of some of our family over there. It was just like our great, great grandfather who allegedly could levitate people. So just all types of unusual stories that were stuck with me as well. I guess the great-great-grandfather would threaten. I still sleep with a sheet over my feet, because he would threaten to grab anybody's feet that weren't covered at night. So I remember that story. My feet to this day are still covered because of that story. So
same here. And that's really cool, that, because I know me and you haven't talked too extensively about, you know, our older members of the family from France, but pretty much what it broke down to was, after World War II, two sisters left and came to America, and the third one stayed, and our grandmas were the ones that came over. But I do remember Maymay, which is what we always had to refer to her as. We couldn't call her grandma, but she told me stories about that. She said he was pretty much an herbalist and was kind of regarded, I guess you could say, as a witch doctor. And according to her, a lot of people in the town, she said it was really odd, because a lot of the people in the town would, you know, he was alienated. He was an outcast. People wouldn't talk to him. But at the same time, when they were sick, you can bet your ass he was the first one that they were going to try to get, you know, the herbal remedies and the, you know, the health side of it, I guess you could say, for whatever.
He could read your eyes to see what was wrong with you, and could find it from that. And from what I understand too, there's even some royalty from, I think, Belgium that would visit him as well.
So. Yes, I did hear that as well. And I've tried so hard to research into him a lot more, but, you know, I don't speak French, and they're not translating those kind of records into English anytime soon, you know, and that's on very limited information that I do have, which is, because I would love to do an episode on him. But
that would be fascinating, because he was, I guess he had been pronounced dead and raised from his deathbed. You know, they had pronounced him dead, and I guess a few hours later, he just got off that deathbed and scared everyone. So, all the stories are, he's a fascinating man. And that's, again, that might be where we get some of our interest. I don't know.
Maybe genetic. I mean, I have an unhealthy interest in the occult, not getting into too many specifics of what I believe and what I don't believe, but I have a very, very vast and unique and unhealthy obsession with the occult. And it's weird, because, you know, I didn't find out about him until after that. And when I found out, I was like, you know, that's really fucking awesome that it's, you know, in the bloodline, I guess you could say. And it's just intriguing to me, I suppose.
The good thing about, if you're doing the research now, things that can work in your favor that couldn't, that is, you've got things like Google Translate, so you can put, you know, copy out a line, pop into there and translate to see, and then you could, you know, do your own, write the words that you want, you know, as your search tool in there, and input, you know what I'm saying? Having things like Translate Now can be very helpful. I grew up taking French, but if you don't use it, you lose it. So I lost much of my French, and I need to, you know, reimmerse myself into it. But it would be helpful.
Yeah, and our grandma tried, you know, she started off teaching us, you know, nursery rhymes or songs in French and stuff like that. And, you know, it's...
There were some good stories. I remember the one song they would sing about the wolf eating a child.
Yes.
So...
Yes, and I can't remember the name of that incident, but I do want to do a future episode on that, actually, because it's a pretty intriguing story, and our grandmothers didn't come from, you know, I mean, they came from a fairly good-sized port city, but, you know, it's not like they were from, like, you know, Paris, France, or, you know, Paris, or anything like that, but... But yeah, some of the stories are pretty fascinating, and we actually have another relative who's on a postage stamp in France, Etienne.
The Explorer.
Yeah,
Etienne Poe.
Etienne Poe. Yeah,
I used him as a basis of a novel I wrote. I used the idea of the Explorer, but I took the idea of him as a pre-Columbian explorer and running into a lot of supernatural elements while exploring the New World. Because I was fascinated by this man. I'm like, well, let's take someone like him and put him before the time of Columbus coming to the New World.
So. Yeah. Yeah, I had known about him, but I didn't know to the extent until some family members sent postage stamps with his fucking picture on it. And they're like, hey, you know, he's legitimately, you know, a historical figure now. And what it is he pretty much pioneered underwater photography over in France. And this was way back, I believe, in the late
1800s. Yeah. And I think he had done some exploring on the sub-Antarctic islands, the French islands there, which are all obviously uninhabited.
Yeah, it was very intriguing. And I've actually... I've searched enough to where I've seen some of his photographs, and it's really fucking cool. It's for old photography like that to be underwater for one of the very first underwater photographers. I mean, it was super cool to see some of those pictures of him and all that stuff. And some of his ship logs, I found some of the ships that he was on as well. But yeah, so I guess we kind of like went off there on a tangent with some family history there, but
it shows we get inspired. You know, I think that really shows how you and I have come to the parts in life where we are now. You know, the stories we've got about these people helped, I think, in a way, lead us on our own journeys.
I agree. That's very well said. You said you have thought about making the jump into true crime. Can you tell us a little bit about that with your writing?
I would have to find the right story, but it makes sense. Here's the other thing. I taught law for 8 years. In teaching law, I also, on many occasions, would teach some criminal justice classes. So it only makes sense to try dabbling in something to that effect, because a lot of my fans would have an interest in that. Now, we've been to places where true crime occurred. I mean, I'm sure you guys have talked a lot about Lizzie Borden on the show. And we spent time at the Lizzie Borden house and, you know, studying what happened there. So it only makes sense to try dabbling into something new. We're looking at some certain cases. The big case was out of Kentucky, and it was Rob Farrell, the vampire killer.
Yeah.
And my co-author with that would be Eric Werner, and he's a very popular occult researcher. And he's going to be looking at the vampire aspect of the crime, and I'm looking at the legal aspect of the crime. Now, of course, nothing he did there was legal, but what we're going to be doing in some of the cases is looking at some of the First Amendment issues as well on other cases. For instance, now, this probably won't be in the book, but in First Amendment, you have both the Free Exercise Clause and Establishment Clause. The Establishment Clause, basically, you know, you can't have a state religion. You can't have the Church of the United States and such. And the second part is giving people the right to believe what they want to believe. So, on that, you know, we talk about some of these cults. You might be able to personally believe in virgin blood or whatever, but you can't actually go through with it. And plus, finding a virgin anymore.
It's fucking impossible.
The reality is, people have a right to believe what they want, but they can't necessarily practice what they believe. So if they want to, you know, whatever you want to believe is your right. But practice is another story. We could go to something simple like polygamy. You might think that it's perfectly acceptable to have multiple wives, but with the exception of living in a few counties of Utah or Arizona, you're not going to be able to practice polygamy at the U.S. Constitution unless they strike down the statutes that are already in place. So looking at some of this, we're looking at some people who had some occult beliefs, and we're looking at the cases themselves, and I'm looking at other elements that are attached legally. So it's basically trying to put the case out there on two different sides, you know, the belief side and such. I don't know if that makes sense or not.
We're
starting with Rod Farrell, and we're probably going to do the West Memphis Three.
Yeah.
And a couple others, and looking at elements of the case, breaking down the case itself. Because my co-writer, he wanted someone with a legal background and really, you know, tear the elements apart and such.
Yeah, definitely. And West Memphis 3 is honestly probably the ideal case for that. There's so much going on there with the crime itself and with the legal aspect of, you know, what ended up happening with those three young fellas. And I mean, personally, I have my opinion. I don't want to say for 100% that they're innocent, but I don't think there's certain avenues that were explored to the extent that they should have been, I guess you could say. And then other people involved, I guess.
There's a tendency when someone is different to initially accuse. I mean, we're just going back to our great-great-grandfather. You know, I'm sure if something happened in town, he might have been one of the first people they would have, you know, pointed the finger at. So when you're different, people like to point the finger.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That is exactly right. And this is right in the middle of the satanic panic. And I'm actually doing a disappearance right now from 1988 that, you know, might have some of those same, I don't want to say qualities, but some of those same tendencies when it came to suspects and people involved, even the police.
And and that's what we're trying to do. The Farrell was another one, though, because this was a guy who believed, I guess he still believes he's a vampire.
He does, yeah.
And, you know, that's when how do you put it? I guess it was from Vampire the Masquerade, if I remember right, playing that. You just got to realize there's a reality and there's a fantasy, and you've got to be willing to separate the two. You have to realize that when your game is over, your game is over. You know, you can't continue. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people that don't know how to separate fantasy from reality.
Yeah. That is very, very good point right there. It's, you know, sometimes that's some muddy waters for people, and they can't differentiate, you know, between the fantasy and the reality of it. Some of your upcoming books, what do you got? What do you got in the works, Kevin?
Oh my gosh, I've got so many. There's different stuff that's out with the editors right now. I basically got a novel that I basically say it's Red Dawn with zombies. Basically, the kids come away, when they come back, the town's been overrun by zombies rather than by communists. So, you know, just back to our own 80s movies, you know, because you're inspired by anything and everything. I've got a collection of horror stories dealing with sports called Soccer Hooligans for Zombies. One that's called Sharon's Steamship, which is stories that are dealing with the horror and waterways, like, you know, oceans, lakes, whatever. I come up with a theme many times, and I write a book around it. I've got my follow-up to True Legends I'm working on right now, which would be more vampire stories. I do novels and short story collections both, you know. Short stories are great, because Stephen King does a lot of them, too. It's probably a horror people can relate to when I talk about it, and so did Edgar Allan Poe. And Of course, I'm the Edgar Allan Poe with less talent and more disturbing. So yeah. I'm kidding. No. But I come up with an idea and a theme, and I write a book around that many times. I've got a lot of collections coming out. So I've probably got about 5 or 6 books that are at the editors right now. I'm also doing another book where we're going to be looking at the non-traditional backgrounds of Christmas called Have Yourself a Merry Little Krampus. We're going to deal with, you know, Krampus and Krampus Nacht, but we're also going to look at, like, some of the pagan origins of Christmas that were absorbed into the early Catholic Church.
Yes.
You know, the Christmas tree, the holly mistletoe, and where it comes from. And so there's a lot of projects we're working on. And the other is called Restless Spirits, where we're going to be looking. I told you about Eerie America, where we went to the unusually themed or haunted or anything else on travel. I'm doing the same thing with wineries, breweries, distilleries, and bars. So it's going to be called Restless Spirits, and we're close to being finished with the initial drafts on that as well.
Very, very cool. Very cool. And your current...
it's going to be a big hit, I think, with the ladies. And I don't know about you, I love going to wineries and breweries.
Oh, I love it.
I still have yet to go to distilleries. I want to see a distillery. I just haven't had the opportunity. But in Indiana, for instance, I've been over 30 wineries in Indiana, probably 10 or 15 in Michigan, and a bunch more throughout the rest of the country. So they're great places to just hang out and spend a day.
Oh, definitely. I took a weekend trip down to Lexington, Kentucky not too long ago and went down to Castle Hill Winery down there. And it was literally me and the owner of the winery who sat there and drank wine and talked about everything under the sun for about 3 hours, which was, personally, I preferred it that way. It was just... Yeah. Just me and him, man, just sitting there pounding some wine, and I don't know, I'm a wino. I make my own wine as well, so it was kind of cool talking to him about recipes and stuff like that, and different techniques. And
that I want to do. I've made my own beer, but I've never made my own wine. It's something I definitely want to try.
Oh, dude, anytime you want some recipes, man, let me know. It's definitely a skill that takes a little time to hone in, and it's a learning experience. But I was lucky enough to get it right the first few times and kind of spawn from there. And it's just fun and it's easy. I mean, you mix a bunch of shit up and put it in a dark 70 or 65 degree room for a few months. And
when you screw up, like when I screwed up beer once, I put too much of, I forgot what it was. I think I put the wrong yeast in on one of them, and it exploded into this giant green monster that just took over, and it was horrible. But then sometimes you get it right. Like, I think it was like either a stout or a porter that had a chocolate coffee flavor.
Oh, shit.
But then I did a Canadian beer where I put maple syrup, and it tasted horrible, so I gave it all to an ex-girlfriend, and she broke up. Hey, you want some beer?
Yeah, take this beer with you.
So you never know. You can go right and wrong, but I think it's a perfect idea for a book. I think a lot of people are going to like it because craft breweries and craft just wineries are popping up all over. I mean, just since I come up last, since I've come up last, there's a lot just in the area where I grew up coming out of nowhere. So it's a popular destination for people now. There's definitely money in that.
Yeah, and I was surprised when a tiny little town next to where we grew up, Lao, Indiana, came, you know, they came out with a brewery there. And I mean, there's not even a stoplight in this town. It's literally a 4-way stop, a bar, and like 5 churches. That's it. And they popped up this brewery, and I'll be honest, man, I have not heard anything bad about it so far, which is just simply kick ass because it was preceded by, the Country Heritage Winery, which is doing phenomenal right now.
Yeah. Places seems to keep growing, and the lines are always getting bigger and longer whenever you go there. So it's great to see.
Yeah.
And it's a perfect place, I think, for such, especially for wineries. I mean, that area, it seems like a perfect area to have a winery. So
yeah.
I'm surprised it hadn't happened sooner.
Yeah.
They probably, probably lack some of the laws to make it easier, is my guess.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
We used to have, Indiana has the stupidest liquor law in the country.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah. Today's Sunday, did not buy beer yesterday, because in the state of Indiana, you cannot buy beer on Sunday unless it's from a tap or a bar. Yeah.
It's stupid. I mean, And there's no reason. I still think, and I could be wrong, my thought was always, it probably went back to anti-Catholicism and anti-Judaism in the early, you know, at that time of the state, you know, and many of us that were Catholic and Jewish were immigrant groups, you know, we came over from overseas where a bottle of wine might have been a pop, you know, more than a bottle of wine would be popular at a Sunday dinner or whatever. Oh, so yeah. Let's prevent these outcasts from buying. That's always been my thought.
It's, dude, you're probably not probably that far off.
Prejudicial behind it.
Yeah, and I can honestly say I'm glad I live, you know, 45 minutes, half an hour away from Ohio. I just jumped the line and go buy beer. In all honesty, though, our state loses about $20 million in taxes a year by not selling booze on Sunday. And
it's stupid.
And it comes up every year, and they still keep voting against it. And it's like, for fuck's sake.
There's some lobby that I don't understand. But you also can't, what is, you can't buy cold pop or cold milk at a what do you call it? A liquor store, something weird like that too. There's some other rules to go on with it. There's just all types of crazy sub rules behind the main rule. Crazy.
And I mean, you can go to Ohio. I can buy cold beer in a damn gas station. And I mean, we can buy gas stations or buy beer at gas stations in Indiana, but it's warm. It's illegal for it to be cold. So it's like, it deters from the drinking and driving. It's like, no, it really doesn't. It just gets into your blood faster, and you just appreciate the next cold beer that much more, is what it is. It's like,
well, it brings them to Ohio, and then they might, which is going to cause other problems, as you said. They might end up drinking from Ohio, driving from Ohio.
Oh, yeah, so, yeah. And then you have, God forbid, you get pulled over and get a bootlegging charge, because that's a real thing, too, still. Just fucking insane, but...
There's a lot of silly laws on the book now. That's another story for another day, too. If you look at some of the laws that are still on state's books, you'd be surprised. But it's something that's arcane, and its time has come to be removed, you know, revoked. There's no reason for such rules.
Yes, I definitely agree. So, what else does the future hold for Kevin? And what, I guess, two-part question. If you had to refer people to two books that you have written that you think they would like and that you would personally think are your best, can you refer those books? And then can you give us maybe a little bit of description on what they're about?
Yes. Okay, so I'll start with that second question. If I were to do refer two of my books to start, the first would be Fountain of Blood from Dark Moon Press, and the second would be True Legends from Dark Moon Press. Fountain of Blood is basically, what I did in this book was I took our old favorite horror characters, horror icons, like a werewolf, a vampire, a mummy, a giant cricket, you know, if you didn't have giant monster movies, and I changed them with modern sensibilities. So I've got the story of a mummy that's been raised in Chicago trying to hitch a ride to Memphis because Memphis was of course, we got Memphis in the U.S., but it was also an ancient city of the old Egyptian dynasty. So I'm basically taking our classic horror icons with modern sensibilities. And True Legends is a vampire collection, and it's just very sultry, very sexy, and very stimulating. And I think that my readers would definitely enjoy those too. Unless they want to read a nonfiction, you know, you mentioned my two best, but there's also the Eerie American Paranormal Road Trip for those who would rather be nonfiction versus fiction. As far as what the future holds, well, hopefully getting on the floor soon where I can be inspired again, because it's too hot here, way too hot. I'm hoping to, you know, return in the academia as well, along with continuing producing. We're hoping to get the movie. The goal right now is to have it filmed in November. So it's basically moving forward with the investors. And we've got two ideas for a lower budget versus a higher budget. We're also going to be moving forward with other movie projects and television projects. And I'm just going to keep writing like crazy, because as long as people... don't buy my books. I'm kidding. As long as they buy my books, I'll keep writing. Some of them sit there and have less, you know, are bought less than others. Some are very popular. Some are, you know, less popular. But I'm just going to keep writing.
I suppose my next question would be, if there was one place that you would want to do a paranormal investigation at that you think would have the most activity from the research that you've done and the genre that you're in and the people that you know, What place would that be?
Waverly Hills, no doubt. Just because of the history of the place and the people I've worked with over the years. I don't know if you guys know the Booth brothers or Chris Booth, but, you know, I've had a chance to talk with him many times. A really nice guy, great guy, and they did a couple things, a movie and a documentary at Waverly Hills. And the stories he told me, yeah, it's definitely the place I want to go.
That sounds good, Kevin. Is there anything you want to close this interview off? I mean, obviously, I'm going to post links to your books in the show notes so everybody can check those out and maybe order some if they see something that sparks their interest, which in my genre and my listener base, I'm pretty sure there'll be some people who are definitely interested. Is there anything you would like to close out the interview with?
Yes. Of course, single attractive ladies, I am single, so definitely hit me up. And actually, the voting for the best parent author, Justin has a link on his Facebook page. Please vote for me every day. You can vote once a day.
Yeah.
I'll get your friends to vote. Definitely would like to close the gap between me and the first click person. I wasn't first click for a while, and I kept going back and forth and back and forth. So
it is. It's still really tight.
Great.
Yeah, I'll bump that post again. So,
appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. I'll mention something in the comments. Everybody, you know, we have until December 18th to vote. So we'll be sure to get you that award best we can.
Alrighty, I appreciate it, man.
All right, no problem, Kevin. I'm sure we'll be in touch like always. And thank you for coming on and doing this interview and sharing some stories and telling us about your books, man.
All right, look forward to seeing you on my next trip up. And
yeah, definitely. Take care. Yeah, you too, man.
All right,
bye.